Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the subject of Alzheimer's disease, and we are fortunate to have as our guest Michael Sullivan of the Indiana chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. Art Walkholz, who is a caregiver for his wife, who has early onset Alzheimer's, and is also a board member for the Alzheimer's Association. Art, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Hi.
Good to have you here. And Dr. Vijaya Sirigiri Reddy of St. Vincent Center for Healthy Aging. Dr. Siri, you've given me permission to say that. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. You can join the conversation today by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, Michael, one of the news hook, really, for this show is that you've got an event this weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing, what the Alzheimer's Association is doing
on
Sunday?
Certainly, John. Thank you. It's the Walk to End Alzheimer's, and it's at Military Park in Indianapolis. Registration is at noon, and the walk commences at 1:30. And this is our major fundraiser for the Alzheimer's Association. Almost all the services we provide are free. And the Alzheimer's Association, statewide, we have a toll-free helpline number, which is 800-272-3900, answered day and night and in numerous different languages. We have professional and family educational programs, support groups for caregivers and early stage folks throughout the state, care consultation through a licensed clinical social worker, medic alert and safe return programs, a resource library, and advocacy efforts. So we'd be happy to have anybody contact us at www.alz.org/Indiana if they want more information about the Walk to End Alzheimer's, which is this Sunday, noon at Military Park in downtown Indianapolis.
And can people just show up at noon and participate if...
Yes, we do have on-site registration. It is best to probably go to the website and register before. But yes, we could definitely accommodate folks who show up that day.
Okay. That needs to be brought into a human focus. And could you talk a little bit about your wife's situation, about when she was first diagnosed or when really you began to notice that there might be an issue?
Sure. It goes back a ways. She's 57 now. Her name's Heather. Mm-hmm. And she was diagnosed, well, the final diagnosis came in about 3.5 years ago. That process, just the diagnosis process itself, took about 9 months, seeing several different doctors and neuropsychs, and just having all kinds of tests and ruling out and that sort of thing. The initial part was, gee, does she have a brain tumor or cancer or some, you know, things like that, and just a steady succession of tests that ultimately ruled everything else out. You know, there's no, I guess, there's no real complete diagnosis until somebody passes away. So it's eliminating all of the sort of other potential maladies there.
Well, and I apologize if some of these questions seem intrusive.
No problem.
I don't want to seem insensitive, but I think it will help. And if you are comfortable sharing for people to understand, what symptoms did you notice first, or did she notice first? I'm trying to get people who might be dealing with this to get real practical ideas.
Yes. So let me, you need a little baseline there. So the diagnosis 3.5 years ago, took 9 months to do it. Easily 2 years of sort of stuff going on, weird stuff, I guess, that, you know, you'd try to explain it off as just, you know, stress or doing too many things or what have you. So those kind of things would be, and Heather was quite a multitasker. She comes from a medical background. She was a cardiac surgery nurse. Mm-hmm. She was a PTO president at, you know, at the schools that our kids go to and so forth. So she was very active in things. And one of the first things we noticed was it was getting harder for her to just sort of juggle things. And then progressively from there, I noticed she would get lost while driving, or, you know, things like a detour would throw her off completely. Being with her when we traveled or going to restaurants and not being able to navigate back from a restroom. So just a lot of things like that. The forgetfulness, of course, that's probably the single one thing that people notice the most, losing things and so forth. And, you know, we all have our sort of senior moments when we do that. This goes so far beyond it in terms of the regularity and that sort of thing, that you just know something's not right. And then her friends as well. There are a number of her friends. In fact, our team for the walk is called Heather's Angels, and a number of the early angels, if you will, had approached me and just said, you know, you guys aren't kidding anybody, and really kind of challenged me to say, you know, we've waited long enough. We've got to do something here. And that was, you know, frankly, it was very helpful because I knew something was wrong. Wasn't quite, you know, we've had some conversations with people and even, you know, just Googling memory, and eventually I did my own diagnosis of, gee, this sounds like Alzheimer's, you mm-hmm. know, just by learning about it and that sort of thing. So we kind of knew, but the series of rule outs is sort of, I guess that's what medical and the insurance companies sort of require, a step-by-step approach. And so it just takes time to get through all that.
I want to come back to your story in a bit, but I want to put this in some context here. Dr. Siri, could you talk a little bit and perhaps explain what Alzheimer's is? I mean, put this in some perspective for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Alzheimer's dementia, it is a kind of dementia that we see. It's very common. And what we see with Alzheimer's dementia is, in addition to memory loss, there are other areas of cognition that are affected. Like, it could be your ability to pay attention, your ability to multitask, your processing speed, your language function. It could be your spatial reasoning. That means your ability to calculate depths and distances. So it's not just memory loss, but some other areas of cognition are also affected by Alzheimer's okay. dementia.
And we don't, at this point, really know what causes it?
There are several theories to okay. explain that. Again, you know, there is some theory to say there could be changes in the brain that happen, and there might be some depositions of materials called amyloid mm-hmm. material, amyloid plaques that deposit, which in turn can affect the firing of the neurons. So that in turn affects the memory.
Okay. And I'm presuming at this stage there's not really a cure.
There's no cure. We have treatments to slow the progression of the memory loss. There's no medication to reverse the memory loss that has already happened. And there's no medicine to cure it.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Michael Sullivan of the Alzheimer's Association. We talk a little bit, obviously, the walk on Sunday is a fundraiser. The money that you raise, where does it go right now? Where do you devote the dollars that you raise?
It goes predominantly to the programs and services that we mentioned earlier, support groups, care consultation, family educational programs. And a lot of our publications into we have an excellent pamphlet called The 10 Warning Signs of Alzheimer's Disease. And as the doctor and Art have mentioned, it's like trouble understanding visual images, new problems with words and speaking, misplacing things, decreased or poor judgment, withdrawal from work or social activities. And so it's all that combined is Alzheimer's disease. And so with like the support groups, that's a real godsend for a lot of people because they think, you know, what do I do? The frustration level when they can sit down and talk with other people and get tips on how to work with a person with Alzheimer's disease.
Art, you actually were trying to capture my attention there and indicate the phrase support groups really registered with you. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And it's through the association. So through some mutual friends of people who work with the association, I got involved with, or Heather and I got involved with a couples. I think the name of the group was Learning Together, and it's all for early onset patients, which is different than the symptoms are all the same, but it's different for early and in the later onset. So these were all couples, roughly in there were six couples roughly from their late 40s to mid 50s, and you know, one, we learned more about the disease together, neurologists and Alzheimer's specialists would come in, but a lot of it was just, you know, sharing together. It was originally set as a 6-week program where each week we would kind of focus on a different thing. I think my group's gone on now for 2 years just on our own, 2 years plus, and we've added a couple, you know, as we...
Do you just get together in each other's homes or...?
At the association, actually.
Oh, okay.
Roughly every 6 weeks or so, 4 to 6 weeks, and, you know, we can't always make it at the same time. As a group, we've done lobbying together of our congressional delegation. We share a lot, and so the point, you know, that I'd say is, as much as there are wonderful people out there who, you know, reach out and you know, assist and help and provide support and so forth, there's something to be said for being able to talk with people who are actually in the exact same boat as you.
What sorts of things do you talk about, Art, when you're together? I mean,
we compare notes a lot on what are you seeing. And one of the, you know, the 10 warning signs and the things that Dr. Siri said, I was checking off a number of them mentally in terms of things I see with Heather. And then I also know some of them I don't see, but some of the others in my support group do see. Every patient's path is unique to them. And yet you can say that there are generalities among the sort of population. And so we've all kind of learned that as well. And we, each of us, struggle with certain sort of different aspects to it.
Well, and I guess how widespread a problem is this? I can direct this to either Michael Sullivan or Dr. Siri.
It's very common. 1 in 8 Americans get Alzheimer's disease.
1 in 8?
Yes.
Over the course of their lifetimes, Michael Sullivan.
Right.
There are over 120,000 diagnosed cases in Indiana right now, 5.5 million nationwide. And the scary statistic is that's going to triple by 2050 to over 15 million cases nationwide. And that's why the research funding is so important, because we need to find a way, if we can't cure the disease, even if we could delay its onset or slow its progression, it would save the country billions and billions of dollars spent on care and paid for by insurance, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Is part of the issue here that we have a diagnosis now that, you know, I mean, 100 years ago we would have written this off as senility or people just getting old and didn't have the... Dr. Siri, could you speak
right
to that?
Right. Actually, Alzheimer's, a lot of time, you know, people say, is this Alzheimer's? So it used to be called the old people's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, of course, we didn't have tools to diagnose this earlier. We didn't have any medications to treat this. We didn't have groups or associations like what we have now. So, you know, we do have, you know, so much to do. There are several ways we can help people who are being diagnosed with this.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of treating, offering support groups, counseling, support for the family, caregivers, there's so much that could be done.
We've got to do this fairly quickly, but is there a greater incidence of it now, or do we lack data to be able to really say for sure?
I think we are able to diagnose it better now.
Okay, but there probably was just as much a century ago, and we couldn't respond to it. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. No Limits is part of our local programming at WFYI Radio, and it's made possible by your support. If you've made a contribution during our fall pledge drive, we thank you. If not, please consider supporting WFYI and our local news and programming, shows such as No Limits, Film Sociology, The Economic Club of Indiana, The Art of the Matter, Sound Medicine, Stolen Moments, and Blues House Party. You can call in your pledge at 1-800-233-0020 or make a donation online at WFYI.org. Also, beginning with our November 3rd show, No Limits will be moving to a new time on Thursdays. No Limits will air at 1 p.m. starting next month. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease today on No Limits. Our guests are Michael Sullivan of the Indiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Art Wachholz, who's a caregiver for his wife who has early onset Alzheimer's, and Dr. Siri Gary Reddy of the St. Vincent Center for Healthy Aging. I apologize. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We were talking really about whether there's greater incidence now. It seems to be that the consensus here really is that we've got better diagnostic tools now and are able to realize a little more what we're dealing with. But when we were on the break, Michael Sullivan, you told me something just fascinating about the number of people who probably have Alzheimer's and frankly don't even realize it.
Yeah, this is a scary statistic. It's a bit misleading, but as the doctor said, 1 in 8 people over the age of 65 have Alzheimer's disease. 1 in 2 over the age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. So while that's statistically correct, it's a bit misleading because a person may develop Alzheimer's disease at 85 or 86 and pass away from something unrelated, a heart attack, stroke. So, but the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease is 1 out of 2 in people over age 85.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Rose, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well. Your question, please.
I am asking a question that was thrown at me, well, a theory. Do you think that the shots that we get as we're going to school and all the boosters and all the things that we have to get, is there any possible way that could have an effect on us later in years dealing with Alzheimer's?
Good question. Thank you for calling. Dr. Siri, I think that one's for you.
So the question about any linkage between vaccines and it's linked to Alzheimer's disease. There's no link that has been published or known to date about any linkage of vaccines and the risk of having Alzheimer's because of that.
Do we have any clues? I mean, I know periodically you see the studies. I know that there were concerns that, the aluminum from soft drink cans or whatever might have some connection or anything like that. Is there, if you had to take an educated guess at this point, mm-hmm. would you say, are there environmental things that might be?
There definitely might be some environmental exposure that may be linked. That aluminum is a good good linkage. There is some data about that. But, you know, of the patients I see in my office, you know, we asked that questionnaire, has there been any exposure to heavy metals in the past? And I can tell you, you know, of the patients that I have, you know, with Alzheimer's disease, there might be one or two, maybe. So, you know, percentage-wise, if you take maybe 1% of the people might have had been exposed to these heavy metals and they have Alzheimer's disease. But we don't know. I mean, is that the only causative factor or risk factor? We don't know that for sure.
Yeah, let me follow up real quickly. When you say you meet with patients, I mean, how do you treat them? I mean, what things can we do now? You mentioned earlier that there were ways. Could you talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, sure. At St. Vincent Center for Healthy Aging, we are a geriatric group. So we do consultations at our office. So these are they're people who are coming with a new diagnosis of dementia. So it could be their primary care doctor or family member who, you know, really is pushing the thing here. And they're saying, oh, you have memory problems and you need to see a specialist to diagnose what's going on. Is this dementia or not? Sometimes we get people that, you know, have already been diagnosed with dementia, and they're coming to us for a second opinion to say, okay, is this really dementia? Is there anything else we could do to help? So what we do in our office, again, is we do consultations for these people. So there is it's a team approach that we take. So everybody who comes for these consults will be seen by a geriatrician who does a comprehensive evaluation, medical evaluation. They'll also be seen by a neuropsychologist who does the neuropsych testing, which is the memory testing. They'll also be seen by a pharmacist who reviews all the medications that they are taking. So that's our initial assessment. So we might order some blood tests, we might order a CAT scan to complete the evaluation. And we bring these people back in about 2 to 3 weeks, which is when we give them the results from the test that we did. Mm-hmm. So when we're explaining these results at the second visit, you know, either we are giving a diagnosis of dementia or no dementia. Mm-hmm. When they do get a diagnosis of dementia, what I do is I discuss about the treatments, mm-hmm. medications, and, you know, whenever we agree on whichever medication we're going to start, I go ahead, you know, do that. Not only that, you know, the good thing with our office, with our practice, is we have a case manager who works with the patient and the family. Mm-hmm. And at the second visit, the case manager is giving them all the resources. So all the flyers about, you know, Alzheimer's Association, support groups, the sheet that Mike showed me, the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's dementia. So we put together a folder with all this information for the patient and the family.
And how, Art Walkholz, if I could ask you real quickly, since you deal with this, I mean, how does having Alzheimer's with a life partner affect the life? And again, I apologize if any of these questions seem intrusive, but I think your experience here really helps people understand the impact of Alzheimer's. Do you, for example, do you have children?
We do.
We do? And how old are your children?
24 and 21.
Okay.
The biggest challenge I have with that is one main difference between early onset and the later onset. As I understand it, again, I'm a layman here.
Yeah.
Early onset is genetic.
Yeah.
Whereas the late onset it's a series of risk factors and all of the things that Dr. Siri discussed. So the genetic thing, she was tested for that, and that confirmed it as well. My kids each have a 50-50 chance of having that gene. There's probably a whole nother dialogue on that phenomena in an organization called, or a study called the DIAN study, Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network, and we've been in contact with them. They really want to study the healthy offspring of adult early onset patients. So my kids are fit exactly what they would like to have in their program, or the model, I guess.
And I should say, a little bit later in the program, we're going to be joined by an IU medical professional who's going to be announcing a new research study that they've gotten some major funding for. But I guess before we get to that, I really would like to kind of drill down in practical terms. How has it affected your family's life, Art? I mean,
in a huge way. It's changed it dramatically. I guess the word that I might get is it's a progressive disease. So it's... it starts with subtles, and, I almost have to, I don't look at it day to day, although I will tell you that every day can have unique adventures. Mm-hmm. Week to week is even almost too condensed, but, now that my kids are, we're empty nesters, when they see mom, they notice things a little bit more than I do, in terms of, just changes in behavior and sort of capability. And one of the ones that Dr. Siri mentioned a lot is this, ability to process, and processing can be anywhere from, the room we're in. There's a lot of stuff here. She wouldn't be able to focus on it. She wouldn't be able to tell my glass of water from Dr. Siri's glass of water. Reading a menu at a restaurant and knowing where everything is, she just can't quite process it all. It's just a lot of information. So the progressive nature of it requires just a constant observation of their challenges, and then you've got to manage them. And make accommodations for what she needs help in, and that ranges from getting up in the morning and getting dressed to getting in and out of cars, and right now she pretty much requires full time supervision, and that's a big deal.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet, a question via Twitter that says, has research into the disease shown any changes in the age of onset going higher or lower? Michael Sullivan.
No, not really. I think we're seeing more diagnosis in earlier stage. And the definition of early onset is under the age of 65. And so we're seeing more and more cases diagnosed because it's more thought about. Before it would have been written off as a behavior disorder. Well, just like Dr. Sari was saying, people are now seeing it and thinking, oh, it could be dementia. It could be Alzheimer's.
And when you mentioned earlier that there's we need to do more research and there needs to be more funding devoted to this. At present, how much funding are we devoting toward attempting to determine either a cause or a cure for Alzheimer's?
We talked to Congress through the National Institutes of Health, which is the primary funding source, although the Alzheimer's Association is the second largest Alzheimer's funding source in the country. But not to say that we want to take money away from other health issues, but just as an example, cancer is funded by the National Institutes of Health to about $5.6 billion a year. Heart and cardiovascular, $4.2 billion a year. HIV/AIDS, $3 billion a year. Alzheimer's, $540 million a year. And since Alzheimer's is such a long, destructive process, we think it's absolutely important that Congress increase the funding. And like I mentioned earlier, if we can even delay the onset or the progression of the disease, the payback would be 10, 20, 30-fold.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I've gotten an email question from Rob Beatley. Says, just wondering if there are preventative measures one can take to reduce the likelihood of getting Alzheimer's. Dr. Siri.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
Had a tickle
scratchy
there.
Throat, yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay.
That's one basic thing I tell my patients. You know, whatever is going to be healthy for your heart is going to be healthy for your brain. So a heart-healthy diet, heart-healthy exercise, okay, that will help probably delay the progression of dementia. So that's a basic principle I tell my patients.
Okay, and we've gotten a question that's related to that from Terry Ayer. It says, is there any real difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? My mother is 87 and to me fits the profile of Alzheimer's, although she has been evaluated as having dementia. Is there any difference in the medications or treatments for slowing the process and or dealing with the problem between the two? I'm going to let Dr. Siri and Michael both have a crack at that one.
This is a common question I get every day. Okay. So dementia is the general term given to memory loss that affects your day-to-day living. Alzheimer's is a kind of dementia, and it's the most common kind of dementia we see. So Alzheimer's disease or Alzheimer's dementia is one of the types of dementia that is seen.
And that, Michael Sullivan.
There are probably 40 or 50 different types of dementia. Lewy body disease, Pick's disease, Jakob Creutzfeldt's disease, Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease accounts for about 75% to 80% of all dementia. A lot of those other diseases have a certain biomarker. So what a physician...
What is a biomarker?
For instance, a blood test or a spinal fluid test. And so if a certain chemical appears in the blood, you can say, aha, that person has Pick's disease. So what the St. Vincent's Healthy Aging Center does is a lot of times they'll find out what it is not. So they'll do a blood test or a spinal tap looking for, is it Pick's disease? Is it Lewy body? No, no, no. And you start taking that, you know, three or four dozen candidates and weeding it down. And then with about, 95% accuracy, you can diagnose it as Alzheimer's disease then.
And we're talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing okay.
And your question?
Well, I have come across some research that has to do with autism and memory issues. I actually have a 12-year-old son who has some major memory issues and has autism. And I was wondering if you guys, in speaking about biomarkers, if you've come across any research that's trying to, I don't know if they'd link the two or similarities between Alzheimer's or memory degeneration and autism.
Thank you. Good question. Dr. Siri.
Yeah. There's no linkage between autism and Alzheimer's dementia. There is a direct linkage for Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease. But there's no linkage between autism and Alzheimer's disease that I know about.
Are there any linkages for Alzheimer's that we haven't talked about so far? Michael Sullivan.
There does seem to be a link between diabetes and Alzheimer's. It's being looked at more and more, where people with diabetes are at a much higher risk, 2 to 3 times, of developing Alzheimer's disease. But the research and the studies are just beginning.
And is that somewhat the stage right now? Is that, I mean, even being able to arrive at a diagnosis with Alzheimer's and the scope of human existence, this is a pretty recent development, right? I mean, most of the knowledge we've got is, in the past 25 years?
Yes, it's been exactly 100 years ago when Dr. Alzheimer's in Germany first diagnosed the disease, which it's named after. But you're correct. It's been in the last 25, 30 years when it's really become a much more scientific diagnosis.
And that was an early onset patient.
It was. I imagine you now know a lot more about Alzheimer's than thought you would, Art.
Yeah.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits with our guests, Michael Sullivan, Art Walkholz, and Dr. Siri. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease, and we are fortunate to have as our guest Michael Sullivan of the Indiana chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Art Walkholz, a caregiver for his wife who has early onset Alzheimer's, Dr. Siri Giri Reddy, or Dr. Siri as she's been kind enough to allow us to call her, and joining us now by phone, Dr. Malaz Bousani of the Regenstrief Institute of the IU School of Medicine. Dr. Bousani, welcome to the program.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me.
Good to have you here. Understand you've got some major news that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah. The good news is we have been able to receive funding from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to actually compare the efficacy and the safety of the three commonly used or only available medication for Alzheimer's disease on the market over here in Indianapolis.
So in practical terms, that's going to tell you whether the treatments are working as effectively as they should.
It will tell us in the real world. As you know, our process of approving any drug to be used in the United States require the conduct of clinical trial in much more controlled environment, and people believe that's the first sign of identifying an efficacy. And then we make the assumption that the folks who've been involved in the clinical trial of the drug approval are similar to the real world folks. And what we're finding out more and more in the literature and the research, that assumption is not correct, and that we really need to test the efficacy of these medication much generalizable population. And that is the goal of this new study. We are going to enroll patients in central Indiana from all the memory care practices within Indiana, central Indiana, and who will have very, very limited exclusion criteria, mimic the real patients where the doctor in the real world will consider prescribing these anti-Alzheimer's disease medication, and see which of these three medicines will be better tolerated by certain individual, which will work better than others, if any. And even we're doing some kind of pharmacogenomic study embedded within this trial to even identify a personalized response to these medication based on the genetic profile of the patient.
We are talking about Alzheimer's disease here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is, have there been any studies to show that there's a correlation between alcoholics and people who are not alcoholics in the incidence of Alzheimer's disease?
Good question. Thank you very much.
We do, when people come to our office for consultation for dementia, that's one of the questions we ask. There is no linkage of alcohol and Alzheimer's dementia, but there is a kind of dementia called alcohol-related dementia. So that's separate.
And presuming if there is a connection, I would guess that consuming large amounts of alcohol, if you're you know, subject to early onset Alzheimer's or whatever would not be a good idea?
Yeah, well, again, it may not cause Alzheimer's dementia. It will cause the other kind of dementia called alcohol-related dementia.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you, in gambling terms, then, are you sort of doubling down and greatly increasing your chances?
Well, it goes back to what the doctor mentioned earlier. What's good for your heart is good for your brain. Mm-hmm. So alcohol is not good for your heart. That's consequently not good for your brain.
And do you see that that there are any other, like the health risks, I presume, then smoking and all of the other things are not, don't help either?
Right, they don't.
We are talking about Alzheimer's here on No Limits. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And your question, please.
My grandfather was diagnosed with Alzheimer's back in the early 80s and has since passed away. In the recent past, about 5 years ago, both of my aunts were having dementia problems, and they both were put into nursing homes and very quickly were very ill and passed away. My question is this something that, as a family member, as a close family member, that we should start being tested for at an early age? Is this something that could be genetically disposed to happen to us because it's in our family so much?
Good question. Thank you for calling, Debbie. Well, Dr. Siri.
Yeah, there, as Art mentioned, there is a kind of dementia, this a variant of Alzheimer's, which is early onset. And the early onset is genetic. Mm-hmm. That will run in families. So if your grandfather, you know, it depends when he was diagnosed, at what age was he diagnosed with this dementia? Because looks like, you know, your aunts got it, but again, were they young when they got the diagnosis of dementia? So it's tricky because Alzheimer's is so common.
If I could jump in real quickly. I mean, suppose you've got a concern like that. Several family members have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Are there ways we can be tested, and at what age should we start being tested to see if we might be subject to Alzheimer's?
There's no consensus on screening for Alzheimer's dementia. There's no recommendations for that. But if there is a family member who is diagnosed at an early age, like in their 50s or 60s, mm-hmm. that's a trigger to say, okay, you know, other family members also might need some kind of genetic testing to see is this early onset dementia.
Mm-hmm. And Art, I want to bring you in here real quickly. I mean, what?
Yeah, this gets into some interesting things. There's a bit of a catch-22 in our world on this. You can't get the meds that they have until you start showing the outward signs. Mm-hmm. The one thing we know is once you start showing the outward signs, at the end of the day, there's nothing they can do for you. There are things that might help.
Manage the decline a little bit, but that's about
right.
It.
Yeah. So there is, I understand as well, there's lack of consensus, but there is some theories out there that things are happening as many as 15 years ahead of time and that don't project outwardly, or the nuances are so nuanced that they're not seen. The FDA does seem to be aware of this now, or has acknowledged it, that we need to move up the testing and the research so that, you know, who knows, maybe Aricept and Namenda and Exelon would be far more helpful if they were provided 5 or 10 years sooner. Maybe not, but gee, no one's really gone after that one yet.
Dr. Bustani, please. I was going to pull you back in anyhow to see
sure.
if, please.
I mean, this is the area of dementia screening. I have spent more than now 10 years on it. And the first time when we published the guideline of the United States Preventive Service Task Force in 2003, and at the time we recommended that there is really insufficient data to recommend for or against dementia screening, and that this decision need to be very, very individualized based on the person's own belief and all expectation and her or his primary care physician. Regarding the cholinesterase inhibitor in general, these anti-dementia medication, they have been tested in the early stages or what we call pre-Alzheimer disease or mild cognitive impairments, and they haven't, have contributed significant change in the trajectory of the disease. So I don't think these cholinesterase inhibitor will be the solution for the core. If you find out you have a genetic profile or you're high risk already by your family history, that these medication will not work. Now, genetically, should you go and do genetic testing, I think for the core in particular, right now there is no recommendation. I would not recommend genetic screening at this time. What I will do, just from the family history, you are at high risk. What can you do under your control to change your high risk without harming yourself? Number one, take care of your heart. That will translate for a good reason preventing or maintaining the health of your brain. Specifically, make sure your cholesterol is well controlled, your hypertension is well controlled, your diabetes is well controlled. Make sure you exercise physically for 15 minutes of moderate intensity exercise on a daily basis. If you can do some kind of a brain exercise for 60 minutes on a regular basis without driving you crazy, so up an exercise.
What do you mean when you say a brain exercise?
Exercise, there's a lot of things. So any exercise that will focus on helping your speed of reacting, your brain speed is going to help. So what I recommend in our Health and Aging Brain Center at Wishart for these folks like the caller is to try to find a video games or go online and find a game that will tell you or challenge you to solve a mystery and have a timed solution. So you try to solve a mystery within the shorter period of time and do that for 60 minutes every day. That is not going to harm you, but there is possibility that might help you. So we call that a brain exercise. If you don't have access to video, you don't have access to internet, you don't feel comfortable with the computer, then you can try to do the puzzle, play puzzles, do some kind of crossword puzzling and the other type of
basically problem solving then.
Exactly. That's the whole thing that will help you out. The last thing you can, which is something very emerging situation, this has happened in our lab just for the past couple of years. If you are exposed to specific type of medication, we call them definite anticholinergic medication, like Benadryl, like amitriptyline, paroxetine. These medication we found out in Indianapolis in our study that they will, if you were completely normal at time zero or baseline and followed you for 5 years, the group who received one of these medication had 60 to 80% more chance of developing cognitive impairments and some type of maybe early Alzheimer's disease. So what I would recommend for the caller is to scan her medication, talk with a doctor, make sure she's not taking bad medicine, and take that away from her. So there's stuff that you can do right now that will help you, even if you are at high risk, really reduce your chance in the future without harming yourself. And the last thing what I would recommend is just to keep in touch with research. This area of preventing Alzheimer's disease is very, very hot on the research area. And there will be something coming up over the next couple of years that might end up changing our entire perspective of how we treat this devastating disorder.
Where should people track that information?
I think the best thing you can do it is on the Alzheimer's Association website, the National Alzheimer's Association. They have access. And then you can get to the National Institute on Aging website. The NIA website is also track this progression. And every year, our National Institute on Aging, our federal government institute, produce an annual report of an update on research available for the public.
We've gotten a question from email question from a listener. It says, I am a 46-year-old man with no Alzheimer's disease in my family. Sometimes, once or twice a month, I momentarily, for 5 or 10 seconds, forget simple things such as my wife's or my daughter's name. Is this an early sign of Alzheimer's? Dr. Siri.
This is an early sign of some kind of memory problem. It needs to be tested. I would say, you know, that is alarming, that, okay, you know, forgetting names of familiar people, your family, that's an alarming sign. I would recommend you see a doctor and get this tested.
Okay. Steve, welcome to the program. We've got just about a minute, so if you could ask your question very quickly.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
My father's been diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, mm-hmm, and he's gone, that was about 3 years ago, and he's slowly been declining, but last month he's completely fell apart. He can't walk anymore. He's in a nursing home, so I was wondering what the difference was between Lewy body and Alzheimer's, and I'll take it offline.
Great. Thank you for the call, Steve.
Okay.
Thank you. Dr. Siri.
Yeah, the different kinds of dementia, the way they differ is how they progress. Alzheimer's disease is a slowly progressive disease. And the medications that are on the market are to treat Alzheimer's disease or Alzheimer's dementia. Again, there are other kinds of dementia like vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, Parkinson's dementia, Pick's disease. There are no drugs for these other kinds of dementia. But because we don't know clinically, we don't know for 100% what kind of dementia it is, there might be an overlap of some Alzheimer's with these other kinds of dementia. So we sometimes use the medicines used to treat Alzheimer's for, you know, maybe a vascular or a mixed kind of dementia to help that Alzheimer's component.
Michael Sullivan, real quickly, in about 10 seconds, can you tell us what we can do to help on Sunday?
Please participate in the Walk to End Alzheimer's at Military Park. Registration starts at noon, and the walk commences at 1:30. And you can visit our website, www.alz.org/Indiana, for further details.
I want to thank my guest for today's program, Michael Sullivan of the Indiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, Art Walkholz, who is caregiver for his wife, who has early-onset Alzheimer's, and Dr. Vijaya Sirigiri Reddy of the St. Vincent Center for Healthy Aging, also Dr. Malaz Busani of the IU School of Medicine. Please join us next week when we will be completing our two-part interview of the mayoral candidates, and we'll be sitting down with Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard. Have a good week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m. And you can listen online at WFYI.org.